Today is May 6th, 2023, 16:51 hours Eastern Daylight Time currently. Ward Green with you today, once again. I'd like to begin today's study, or today's session, with a song performed by Lou Rawls. I've got it on loop. got to stop it because it was on loop. Okay, so this is the one I want, I think. No, that's not the... This is it, perhaps. Let's see. Right here. Today's study. I've got a complex study today. This is not right, is it? Let's see. We want it to look like that, or do we? Not sure. We're showing... Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, we're showing a reversed image here. So it needs to be the way we want it to look. The way I've done this is I go into accessibility display and I invert the colors. Then after I'm done, I use DaVinci Resolve to invert the colors again. And that way I'm able to get... I'm inverting the colors in OBS Studio as well. So the only way that this works is if I do that, because I want to be able to see it as though it's in the actual proper method, the proper colors. I want to see them while I'm recording. But I have to record inverted in order to get the colors correct, the white on black. So in the text, So I think that this is right because we've got the white on black here, so we want this one to be also black background, or else it will be too bright for some people. I think this is right. It's got to be. Okay, we want to get rid of this song for now. The lyrics. I want to show you that in 1468 BCE, which is what this is, showing it on here, May 11th is the date of the lunar day 1, which is new moon, in Israel and in the northern delta of Egypt, which is plus 3 time zone, 3 hours east of Greenwich, which is local time 21:49, according to our own calculations. Okay, that's... late night almost. It's pretty late in the evening, where the new moon falls on May 11th in the year 1468 BCE. Keep that in mind, okay, because we're going to talk about that. The other thing I want to show you is Rita Gauci calculates 1468 for her. She calls it minus 1467. That's the standard scientific notation. It's May 10th. That proves we're in the right year. And it's May 11th, a new moon, which is also proves we're in the right year. The May 10th here is the last visibility of that moon at 1:50 in the morning, but that's Greenwich time, so we have to add 3 hours. And then we also have to add 3 hours to the 18 hours of the new moon, which is 21:31. We had 21:49, so we're close to what she calculated also. But that's the new moon. It goes... These are the data for Babylon, not for Israel, but it's a similar latitude, so we're going to say this is good enough. So it's May 10th is the last visibility, which would be about 5 in the morning, local time. At that location, which makes perfect sense. And the May 11th is the conjunction. That's not visibility. That's when the moon is completely invisible, when it's corresponding exactly to being opposite from the sun. So it's 18 plus 3 hours for Babylon. Well, wait a minute. For Babylon? Where is Babylon? I'm trying to think. Is Babylon? This is for Babylon. Right? Babylon's in the... I think Babylon's in the same time zone as Israel is. Because I remember using 3 hours for Babylon, too. Plus three. I used plus three for both Babylon and Jerusalem. So I believe they're in the same time zone. Obviously, it won't be the same, though. They're further east. So for them, local time, what's it going to be? Let me think. Or what would it be? They're further east. So, well, just like nowadays, the sun comes up here at 6 in the morning, right? But in California, it's they're 3 hours behind us because the sun hasn't reached them yet coming from the east. So things happen earlier in the east. So therefore, but with the moon, let me think. But the timing will be later in Babylon because they're further east. The sun has already gone past. Right. So this looks like in Babylon, this is later. But that's interesting. But it's still the same time zone, so it's not going to make too many minutes difference, right? So maybe she got a very similar number to what we get in Jerusalem if she'd done her calculation for Jerusalem. Or would she? I don't know enough about that just yet, but we can find that out. The other thing I wanted to look at, though, this is how she calculates the last sighting of the moon, the date, then the time of that last sighting, and then the date according to the Babylonish calendar, which is the day of the month of that calendar, which we're not interested in right now, but also the new moon date after that. So the new moon comes last. That's what we were looking at there. That's just to show you her convention that she's using. And then to look at Fred Espenach, he has 1468 as also minus 1467, the conventional scientific way of expressing 1468 BCE is minus 1467. He's got May 11th, but he's got 1811. Now, this is not for any particular place. That's universal time. So that's the same everywhere. So it doesn't matter if you're in Babylon or where you are. I guess it doesn't really matter except for the time when it occurs. That's all. Because the local time is different depending on how far east you are. So, but here we have 1811. He gives universal time again. So Greenwich time. So we've got to add the 3 hours. 2111 he gives for the new moon right there. May 11th, 1811 is 2111 local time for Babylon. So, I mean, we can get into this deeper and deeper and deeper, but we're not able to, obviously, because of time limitations. But we had 2149 local time when we did the calculation on the Will of Jehovah website. Now, today I want to read this footnote to paragraph 8:7 for us. Little children. Now, this is going to be complex, but I don't want to skip over it. And we want to start with 8:8 tomorrow, I think. So a foundation ceremony might fall upon, Jehovah willing, Lunar Day 2, if that were required, to ensure that a new moon arrived beforehand, lest Lunar Day 1 rituals be seen to wrongly precede new moons. This does apply to the February 20th, 1466, year 24 date. That's a later date than the one we just looked at, which comes after a new moon falling on the night of February 19th, thus assuring that this date in the BG is a new month. A year 1, 1479 BCE chronology, lowers it to February 17th, 1455, a date which suffers by its being a day earlier than conjunction. One serious deficiency of alignment. The Arcus Physionis benefits from a 3-degree reduction according to shock. Now, this is not the 3 hours we just talked about. This is a 3-degree reduction in the elevation above the horizon. According to shock in Babylon, 7.6 compared to 11, which was Ptolemy's number. This leads to an expected reduction in Israel also, in comparison to the Egyptian value of Ptolemy. For Arcus Visionis, which applies to the year 23 Megiddo date, because that's in Israel, of May 12th, 1468, Thutmose III being in Israel and at war. So even though the new moon appears to fall on May 11th, using the standard assumptions, it is the night of May 11th. And good visibility can shift lunar day 1 to May 12th. Now, this is where it gets very confusing, okay? Well, it's the night of May 11th, so if it were good enough visibility in the morning of May 11th, it might be possible, since there was about 17 hours difference between, or almost 17 hours difference between the last sighting and the new moon. It's possible, maybe, that the last sighting, let me think now, wait a minute, the new moon. Yeah, it's possible that the last sighting could have been in the morning of the 11th, not the morning of the 10th, because of how late the new moon was on that day. There could have been a previous sighting on the same day as the new moon. That's where this is getting tricky. On May 11th, the moon is 24 hours from new. Now, what do I mean from that? What do I mean by that? That's the point where I'm not even sure what I mean by that. Oh, yeah, right. Well, it's interesting. It's not really true, literally, that it's 24 hours from new, because it's new on the same day, it would appear. So I don't know. This is one statement that I don't fully understand about my own writing here, but I was much deeper into it at that time. It's going to take us time to come up to speed again. And it can, from PLSV 3.0, the program, Planetary, Lunar, and Stellar Visibility, be seen with an arcus visionis of 5.36 degrees. There we go. It can be seen with an arcus visionis. That's what I mean. So I did read this before, but now I see why I'm saying it. It can be seen if the arcus visionis is as low as 5.36 above the horizon. So adding, if it's visible at that degree, at that angle above the horizon, so adding 3.4 degrees to that, which was the difference between Ptolemy and Schock, just given a few sentences ago, we get 8.76 degrees, 3.4 added to 5.36, and that's nearly the 9.4 degrees within the error required for Egypt. So we also expect Israel would be similar, but we're going to say the army would have someone with good vision doing it. That's the other statement I made there. So it is plausible that May 12th was actual new moon for that month in Israel, most especially since new moons are visible in Israel today when as young as 28 hours. And that's not necessarily by people with the best of vision either, possibly. We don't know who's making these observations. Recorded dates of pharaohs which correspond to a lunar day 1 are special events, because lunar day 1 has significance in Egyptian religion as the new moon, which was possibly day 1 to the Egyptians, right? We don't actually even know that, but that's what Parker established, and everybody has agreed with Parker since that time. However, perhaps we should be using this as an example of how lunar day 1 was decided by the Egyptians on war maneuvers, since nobody knows for sure. And any exact day of the feast of the new moon, with the words exact day of the feast of the new moon in quotes, as the year 23 date was called, maybe lunar day 1. As appears implied. And yet, it is just possible that feast day, quote, feast day, unquote, falls really on lunar day two. This is a really, really interesting point. Since Papyrus Berlin 10132N mentions 12 lunar day two feasts and 12 full moon feasts in isolation, for example, over a year. The fact is, there are many things we don't know about it, except that we have near-perfect lunar alignment. When we attribute to the Egyptian astronomers as great an acumen as we expect of modern counterparts, it will be seen that May 12th is truly lunar day one in 1468 BCE, when seen from Megiddo. As midnight at the start of May 12th makes the first day that the lunar conjunction is gone past. And the same is also truly said of February 20th, 1466 BCE, which is the year 24 date of the foundation ceremony, actually. So this is really a striking statement in this footnote of paragraph 8-7 in the Wild Road article part 2. That's chapter 8, paragraph 7, footnote of the asterisk footnote. So it's interesting that because the new moon occurred so late in the day, it can occur any time. Like, the visibility can only occur either in the morning or at night, but the conjunction can occur any time in the 24-hour period. It's just when is the moon aligned between, you know, or when is the moon aligned with the Earth in between the moon and the sun? That's what it really is. Or in the case with the moon in between the Earth and the sun in the case of a new moon, and the moon on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun in the case of a full moon. So when the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, the sun cannot shine directly on the moon. It's shining from the back of the moon, and that's why it appears black and therefore new. That's what we call new moon, when the moon is in between the Earth and the sun. So, I mean, it's interesting here, but because it was very late in the day that the conjunction, that's called conjunction, occurred, why would they consider the first day of the month to be that same day? Why wouldn't they consider it to be the next morning as the beginning of that lunar day one? So that makes perfect sense when we look at it in as much detail as we do here in that footnote. It makes entirely perfect sense that that's the correct date. Plus we have another fact, interesting fact, is that the conjunction was... Oh, wait a minute. Let's go one more time to our data here. It was May 11th, late at night, right, when the conjunction occurred. That's the new moon. That's called lunar day one because we assume that the Egyptians took new moon as lunar day one, okay? But lunar day one, because it started so late at night, we don't know where their cutoff was. Maybe they said that they would start lunar day one the next morning. That's assuming our calculations are completely accurate, and we don't even know that for sure. So, I mean, it's fascinating, but it's on the 11th, okay? So if lunar day one was the 12th, based on that assumption, that could explain how it works perfectly for us that they recorded May 12th in their calendar, the equivalent of our May 12th in the Julian calendar in that year, as their exact feast of the new moon, right? They called it the exact feast of the new moon, exact day of the feast of the new moon. But they could have also viewed May 11th as lunar day one, and because the feast of the new moon could have been lunar day two. We don't know. And it especially looks likely, according to the Papyrus Berlin 10132N, which mentioned 12 Lunar Day 2 feasts and 12 full moon feasts. So there it is. It almost proves it right there that the Lunar Day 2 was a feast of the full moon, of the new moon, rather. Full moon, obviously, is the opposite phase. But the new moon, full moon is when the moon is bright, and the new moon is when it's black. So Lunar Day 2 when it's black, and Lunar Day 15 when it's full. For the Egyptians, their full moon was always Lunar Day 15. But they didn't use Lunar Day 1 because it was sacred to them, so they used Lunar Day 2 for their feasts. So the feast of the new moon exactly is perfect if we take May 11th as new moon, which it is, technically, but it's fairly late at night on the 11th. So even then, May 12th works. Either way, we can see it either way as working. So that's really, really good, the way things in the genealogy work out. And it doesn't work out so well for other chronologies, as we illustrate with the 1479 BCE year one, for example. Whereas we have 1493 as year one for Thutmose III. The explanation as to why Thutmose III changed his year one was because on the death of Hatshepsut, she having subsumed the year one of her husband, his father, he, after she died, would perhaps logically have said, well, or it may have been according to the custom too, that his father's reign, having been subsumed by her, you know, and it was as though to him, he was the one who was supposed to succeed his father. She was not supposed to succeed his father, technically. Therefore, he would subsume her year one, even though that would mean subsuming his father's year one as well, if that makes sense, which it seems to. So that's a really, really interesting summation of the dating of Thutmose III in the genealogy. Is it not, little children? I'm going to go now, we're going to go now, if you bear with us here. What else was I going to say about the Bible today? Is there something else, or is it? It's Proverbs 30:28. The gecko lizard takes hold with its own hands, and it is in the grand palace of a king. Okay, that's the proverb. Gecko lizards are actually quite famous these days because there are certain ads that we've seen with gecko lizards in them. So it's actually a very interesting proverb for that reason. Now, Exodus 18. Now, we saw how in Exodus 17, the Israelites quarreled with Moses, and they fought, Israel did, with Amalek. Right. Now, Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, got to hear about all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how Jehovah had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after the sending of her away, and her two sons, the name of one of whom was Gershom, because, he said, an alien resident I have come to be in a foreign land. And the name of the other was Eliezer, because, to quote him, the God of my father is my helper in that he delivered me from Pharaoh's sword. Speaking about Moses. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and his sons and his wife, came to Moses in the wilderness where he was camping at the mountain of the true God. Then he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am come to you, and also your wife and her two sons with her. At once Moses went on out to meet his father-in-law. and he proceeded to prostrate himself and to kiss him. And they, each one, began asking how the other was getting along. After that, they went into the tent. And Moses went to relating to his father-in-law all that Jehovah had done to Pharaoh and Egypt on account of Israel, and all the hardship that had befallen them in the way. And yet Jehovah was delivering them. Then Jethro felt glad over all the good that Jehovah had done for Israel, in that he had delivered them from the hand of Egypt. Consequently, Jethro said, "Blessed be Jehovah, who has delivered you from the hand of Egypt and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of Egypt. Now, I do know that Jehovah is greater than all the other gods, by reason of this affair, in which they acted presumptuously against them." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron and all the older men of Israel came to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before the true God. And it came about on the next day that Moses sat down as usual to serve as judge for the people. And the people kept standing before Moses from the morning till the evening. And Moses' father-in-law got to see all that he was doing for the people. So he said, "What kind of business is this that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone continue sitting and all the people continue taking their stand before you from morning till evening?" Then Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people keep coming to me to inquire of God. In the event that they have a case arise, it must come to me, and I must judge between the one party and the other, and I must make known the decisions of the true God and his laws." At this Moses' father-in-law said to him, "It is not good the way you are doing. You will surely wear out, both you and this people who are with you, because this business is too big a load for you. You are unable to do it by yourself. Now listen to my voice. I shall advise you, and God will prove to be with you. You yourself serve as representative for the people before the true God, and you yourself must bring the cases to the true God, and you must warn them of what the regulations and the laws are, and you must make known to them the way in which they should walk and the work that they should do. But you yourself should select out of all the people capable men, fearing God, trustworthy men, hating unjust profit, and you must set these over them as chiefs over thousands, chiefs over hundreds, chiefs over fifties, and chiefs over tens. And they must judge the people on every proper occasion. And it must occur that every big case they will bring to you, but every small case they themselves will handle as judges. So make it lighter for yourself, and they must carry the load with you. If you do this very thing, and God has commanded you, you will then certainly be able to stand it. And besides, this people will all come to their own place in peace." Immediately Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he said. And Moses proceeded to choose capable men out of all Israel and to give them positions as heads over the people, as chiefs of thousands, chiefs of hundreds, chiefs of fifties, and chiefs of tens. And they judged the people on every proper occasion. A hard case they would bring to Moses, but every small case they themselves would handle as judges. After that, Moses saw his father-in-law off, and he went his way to his land. That's the end of Exodus 18. And now Luke chapter 6. After we saw in Luke chapter 5 some miracles. Jesus healed a man who had leprosy. There was a miraculous catch of fish. He healed a paralyzed man, and he gave some interesting illustrations about the ailing and the friends of the bridegroom and also the wineskins. Now on a Sabbath he happened to be passing through grain fields, and his disciples were plucking and eating the heads of grain, rubbing them with their hands. At this, some of the Pharisees said, "Why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" They were evidently thinking that that was harvesting or something on the Sabbath. But Jesus said in reply to them, "Have you never read the very thing David did when he and the men with him got hungry? How he entered into the house of God and received the loaves of presentation and ate and gave some to the men with him, which it is not lawful for one to eat, but for the priests only." And he went on to say to them, "Lord of the Sabbath is what the Son of Man is." In the course of another Sabbath, he entered into the synagogue and began teaching. And there was a man present whose right hand was withered. The scribes and the Pharisees were now watching him closely to see whether he would cure on the Sabbath in order to find some way to accuse him. He, however, knew their reasonings, yet he said to the man with the withered hand, "Get up and stand in the center." And he rose and took his stand. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, men, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do injury, to save or to destroy a soul?" And after looking around at them all, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was restored. But they became filled with madness, and they began to talk over with one another what they might do to Jesus. In the progress of these days, he went out into the mountain to pray, and he continued the whole night in prayer to God. But when it became day, he called his disciples to him and chose from among them 12, whom he also named apostles, Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealous One, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who turned traitor. And he came down with them and took his station on a level place, and there was a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all of Judea and Jerusalem in the maritime country of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and be healed of their sicknesses. Even those troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd were seeking to touch him, because power was going out of him and healing them all. And he lifted up his eyes upon his disciples and began to say, "Happy are you poor, because yours is the kingdom of God. Happy are you who hunger now, because you will be filled. Happy are you who weep now, because you will laugh. Happy are you whenever men hate you, and whenever they exclude you and reproach you and cast out your name as wicked for the sake of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap. For look, your reward is great in heaven, for those are the same things their forefathers used to do to the prophets. But woe to you rich persons, because you are having your consolation in full. Woe to you who are filled up now, because you will go hungry. Woe, you who are laughing now, because you will mourn and weep. Woe, whenever all men speak well of you, for things like these are what their forefathers did to the false prophets. But I say to you who are listening, continue to love your enemies, to do good to those hating you, to bless those cursing you, to pray for those who are insulting you. To him that strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also. And from him that takes away your outer garment, do not withhold even the undergarment. Give to everyone asking you, and from the one taking your things away, do not ask them back. Also, just as you want men to do to you, do the same way to them. And if you love those loving you, of what credit is it to you? For even the sinners love those loving them. And if you do good to those doing good to you, really of what credit is it to you? Even the sinners do the same. Also, if you lend without interest to those from whom you hope to receive, of what credit is it to you? Even sinners lend without interest to sinners, that they may get back as much. To the contrary, continue to love your enemies and to do good and to lend without interest, not hoping for anything back, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because he is kind toward the unthankful and wicked. Continue becoming merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Moreover, stop judging, and you will by no means be judged. And stop condemning, and you will by no means be condemned. Keep on releasing, and you will be released. Practice giving, and people will give to you. They will pour into your laps a fine measure, pressed down, shaken together, and overflowing. For with the measure that you are measuring out, they will measure out to you in return. Then he also spoke an illustration to them. A blind man cannot guide a blind man, can he? Both will tumble into a pit, will they not? A pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone that is perfectly instructed will be like his teacher. Why then do you look at the straw that is in your brother's eye, but you do not observe the rafter that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, Brother, allow me to extract the straw that is in your eye, while you yourself are not looking at the rafter in that eye of yours? Hypocrite! First extract the rafter from your own eye, and then you will see clearly how to extract the straw that is in your brother's eye. For there is not a fine tree producing rotten fruit. Again, there is not a rotten tree producing fine fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For example, people do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they cut grapes off a thorn bush. A good man brings forth good out of the good treasure of his heart. But a wicked man brings forth what is wicked out of his wicked treasure, for out of the heart's abundance his mouth speaks. Why then do you call me Lord, Lord, but do not do the things I say? Everyone that comes to me and hears my words and does them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug and went down deep and laid a foundation upon the rock mass. Consequently, when a flood arose, the river dashed against that house, but was not strong enough to shake it because of its being well built. On the other hand, he who hears and does not do is like a man who built a house upon the ground without a foundation. Against it the river dashed, and immediately it collapsed, and the ruin of that house became great. That's the end of Luke 6. If a blind man glides a blind man, I was trying to say, or something like that. But a blind man cannot glide. That doesn't make much sense. A blind man cannot glide a blind man? I don't think so. Guide a blind man. The blind cannot guide the blind, can they? Is what Jesus said there. A blind man cannot. A blind man, how can we say that so it's easy to say? A blind man. A blind man cannot direct a blind man, would be maybe the better way, easier way to say it verbally. A blind man cannot direct a blind man, because in the Hebrew language or whatever language Jesus was using there, Aramaic or whatever it was, or Hebrew, it wouldn't be the same words that we're using in English, so if it's difficult for us to say it in English, then maybe we should modify the way it's being said so that we can pronounce it in English without stumbling on the words. Yeah, it's the same in the study version of that verse. A blind man cannot direct a blind man, can he? That might be a better translation from the point of view of actually being able to say it out loud. There are a couple of other things I stumbled on in this chapter. But what I was attempting to do, I was willing to sacrifice accuracy in order to get some emotion. And I think I would have had to sacrifice a lot of emotion if I had been completely accurate, because I would have had to slow down, I would have had to, you know, give no attention whatsoever to the emotion in order to get everything completely accurate. But I think it was fairly accurate on the whole. I hope it was. I mean, so that's today's study. That's all of it, I think. What was there? What more was there to report? Yeah, well, to do with the watches and the research I'm doing on the watches, I just realized now, in my research, I've just realized that the next thing that I need to research is perpetual calendars in watches. The Chinese make all sorts of. The other major thing I need to research with watches is Chinese watches, because they're not known here in the West. We don't know anything about them. Essentially, they're 90% of them are in China. They don't distribute everywhere. So the thing is that there's so many movements in China. There was one watch I looked at today. I couldn't even determine what the movement was. And yet, I believe it was a perpetual calendar or something. It was quite a sophisticated movement. Perpetual calendars are movements or movements that have perpetual calendars allow you to follow and observe and monitor the ongoing course of the changing dates throughout the year without having to reset them at the end of the month. Whereas most calendars, you have to reset them if it's a month shorter than 31 days. You have to advance them past the last couple of days or the last day to get to, if it's February, for example, 28th or 29th, you have to advance 2 or 3 days to get to the new month. Three or four days. Whereas in the case of a month that's 30 days long, you have to advance. No, you don't have to advance 4 days because you're going from the 28th and you're trying to get 1 day more. So it's going to go to the 29th and then you have to advance through the 30th, the 31st, and to the 1st. That's 3 days. So 2 or 3 days at the end of February, and depending on whether it's a leap year, that is. And at the end of a 30-day month, you have to advance one extra day to get past the 31. That's for a non-perpetual calendar in a watch. But if you have a perpetual calendar in your watch, usually much more expensive. They're very burdensome if you ever get stopped, I guess, also. Or if they ever get misaligned anywhere, you have to then go through quite a number of days, possibly, to get back, to get them in alignment again with the perpetual calendar so that you won't have to adjust it. For maybe 100 years, even some of these calendars can go that long. But they're very interesting complications in a watch. And the Chinese movements are so multitudinous because of the number of people in China. Seagull movements are the ones of which I own two, the ST. 16 and the ST-1902. But the seagull movements are accounting for roughly one quarter of all the watch movements in the world of the mechanical watches. And that's incredible. We just don't even know about seagull in the West much at all. Just hardly any of us. So, and yet, seagull's been producing watches since 1955. Anyway, for Ward Green, well, this is a Chinese movement, the PT-5000, Willy, and a Japanese movement, the Seiko NH-35 Moppy. I love you all. It's time to say bye for now.